Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. In Lael Morgan's Alaska Geographic book on the Aleutians, she quotes a tourist who called the islands the Aleutians, a perfect name for the mysterious chain, so far away and expensive to reach. Truly, the Aleutians are at the end of the line as far as the United States government and transportation systems are concerned, and I asked Lael how the people who live on the thousand-mile chain feel about that.
Pretty darn self-sufficient, usually, and I think perhaps on reflection that's why I like the Aleutians so much. People are a good part of it. And the fact that they have been left alone and neglected just makes an independent breed that are unlike any other. And the weather, the sailing directions for the Aleutians say this is the worst weather in the world, and sailing directions are usually pretty conservative. So if you get a person that can take that much neglect and take the weather, they're just bound to be a different breed of cat and really interesting.
Mm-hmm. About the weather in your book, I got the phrase that the Aleutians are the birthplace of the winds and the cradle of the storms. How bad can the weather be?
The first time, I was in Atka for a whole month, and I was doing a story for National Geographic, and I hadn't seen any bad weather, and so I prayed madly, "Dear God, send a storm," and had no idea what I was asking for. And the next day, there was a whopper came in, and I thought, isn't this grand? And I walked a mile to the beach with the wind at my back and stayed about 4 hours and took pictures. And when I came home, I discovered I couldn't walk against the wind. I came home on my hands and knees with my Nikon camera and my teeth. It can get pretty tough. And it blew away one summer camp, which was a very substantial one, took out the walls, everything but a small scrap of the floor, and they had a cast iron stove, which was a full-size one, and it moved that 9 feet.
That's impressive. Very impressive.
You don't want to be sitting in one of those houses when that happens.
The Aleutians then have been subjected to the physical changes. The volcanoes, of course, are unpredictable, and that changes. And they've also had the first contact with cultural changes, and I think the most variety of change, and it's been...
They got really stomped, and it's too bad we don't know as much about them as we'd like to. They apparently had a very superior civilization. They could do surgery. They did brain surgery. They knew suturing. Their clothing, what little we've seen before the white contact, was absolutely marvelous. They were very vain. They liked to dress well, and they were really great seamen, and their art must have been terrific. But we just don't know, because the Russians that came simply wiped out most traces and reduced the population from about 15,000 on down to 2,000 in less than 50 years. And when you do that, you lose your oral history, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was really tough. And then they adjusted very well. They learned to speak Russian. Some of them began to run businesses down there. They were sent to Russia to go to school. There are things written, but the problem is that they've been in Russia for a long, long time. We haven't had very many historians who could read Russian.
Also, they would be the Russian perspective.
That's the problem. It really is the Russian perspective. And there was no one in here who was interested in history until roughly 50 years after the first contract attack, because the first guys in were fur traders, and they were just after the money, and they didn't care about anything else. And there doesn't seem to have been any literate exceptions to that.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's hard digging. But you do have one thing. I mean, you have... Aleuts, more than most people I know of, are really tied to their homelands. And when you take them away, you know, they're very sophisticated people. They read a lot and so on, but they get very homesick,
mm-hmm.
as I do for the Aleutians when I'm away from it. They're very tied, and I think that what's in their hearts is exactly what was in the hearts of the people who lived there 2,000 years ago. You know, you get a feeling for a place, and I think that's shared.
Well, one of the things that seems so really atrocious of in what happened on the Aleutians, from the Russians, World War II, even
recent history with people moving people around, regardless of where they were born. The people were evacuated. They were then, well, maybe you should tell us what happened in the Attu Atka situation and what the physical moving around of people has done.
Well, they were a victim of war, and you can say what you want to about the U.S. government. The government had a very hard decision. They agonized when they saw World War II coming on the horizon. They knew the Aleutians were going to be hit. And Bob Bartlett's papers show that they were, whether you evacuated the people and put them, they couldn't find any place similar. They didn't know where to put them. And they waited too long to make the decision. The Japanese moved in and evacuated all the Attu people to Japan. They liked the Attu people. They treated them much better than they did the white people, and they tried to get them to stay. And it was terribly hard on them. I mean, they were captured and imprisoned, mm-hmm. and it wasn't any piece of cake. But the Japanese did try. The Attu people lost half of their village in Japanese captivity. They lost a lot of them to tuberculosis, mm-hmm. and in the end, there was practically nothing to eat. And but the Japanese didn't have any more to eat mm-hmm. than the Aleuts did at that point, too. The rest of the chain was evacuated to camps in southeastern Alaska, and they were old canneries. They didn't provide them. They evacuated them in, like, well, Atka had no notice at all, and St. George had 25 minutes or something to get onto the boat. They were allowed to take just what they could carry in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. And then they weren't furnished with much for food, clothing. In fact, a study I just saw said that the average American prisoner of war, we fed the Germans 1,900 calories a day, and we fed the Aleuts 1,700 calories a day. And of those who lived in southeastern, only half came home. I hadn't realized how bad it was until I looked at there's a court case on this now. The Aleuts are suing the U.S. government. And at the end of the testimony, which I knew about, just the lists of the dead, and it's page after page after page of people who died down there, just their names, and it really hits you really hard. It was a tough, tough time. And then when the people did come home, they discovered their villages had been trashed by the occupying American troops, and the government was going to award them money and boats and Victrolas to make up for mm-hmm. what they'd had. And the fellow who was to do the warding just couldn't handle the job and was removed, and it fell upon the marshal of Unalaska to distribute there, and I'm not sure who made the distributions otherwise, but some people got the things and some people didn't get anything. And where they'd had an economy, they'd done pretty well in the fur trade, they'd had a fishery. When they came home, the fish in Unalaska were gone. The military had filled in the herring spawning grounds, and they'd blocked a lot of streams where the salmon came back. And it was just flat no economy. And they, at the point they'd been evacuated, at the beginning of World War II, they were finally getting a leg up. They mm-hmm. had done well in the fur trade. Atka made something like $65,000 in 1 year in the fur trade for 100 people in a village. That's pretty good money before World War II. And they were really doing well. They had nice homes, they had nice clothes, and they were living well. And then came back and there was nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's been a real hard time to recoup.
What about the health of some of the crafts and the...
The basketry was renowned, and I've tried making other baskets, and that's not that much of a problem, but Atka baskets, Attu baskets are really, you could go blind in a hurry, and it takes years to do the very, very fine weaving they do. The Atka people, of course, were sent to Southeastern, and the grass is different. And so that generation that was in those camps didn't learn basket making. And when they came home, they were too busy trying to rebuild their lives. Mm-hmm. And in 1972, the first year I was in the village, the older women taught women who were 45 with their daughters and granddaughters to make baskets. And some of them have gotten quite good at it in a short time. And I think that's one thing that seems to be carried on. There's not that many, and the baskets are very rare. If you don't get a good season, if you don't get enough sunlight, you can lose a whole year's worth of grass. And so the price of a good grass basket now goes from $500 to $1,000, mm-hmm. but it also represents months of work. But it is being carried on. It's not great hordes of people, and mm-hmm. not just everybody does it, but it's there. And that's about it. Aleuts were apparently fabulous carvers, and we don't even know very much of their work because most of it lies in Russian museums or carried off before Americans got any toehold.
Going along with that, what about some of the the older traditional ways of hunting, and tell me about the, I'm going to say, Bidarkas?
Yes, the skimbles.
Yeah.
They were absolutely marvelous. There were no better seamen in the world than the Aleuts. And the kayaks that they had, you had to continual balance like a bicycle, or they would tip over. And but they were superb. They would go all the way from Attica to Kodiak in those things, and that's several days' journey. Mm-hmm. Men would go in a group and raft together at night so that they could rest. And it was just marvelous craft. And then they had bigger boats, too. That, there hasn't been any of those made since before the war. Mm. And there's a couple. Ted Bank got a movie of one being paddled by an old-timer. But this, that really, and they had a Badaka building class in Unalaska school, which was interesting. And they got three old-timers to advise them on Badaka designs. And they had a horrendous fight because each one thought their design was the right design. And I think what we were seeing was three different village designs or three mm-hmm. different traditional. And they could never quite come to an agreement on how this thing should be mm-hmm. built. And the project got stalled. Mm-hmm. And there's just not enough left.
Yeah, a mistake that people might make looking at that little inset of the Aleutians on the bigger map of Alaska, you might think that everybody that's an Aleut is the same, but actually they're very much tied to places, or in the past had been tied to particular islands, and the languages were intelligible to each other, but different, I think. Isn't that
the,
right?
The chains are 1,000 miles long.
And there was even fighting.
Oh, they were marvelous warriors. Yes, yeah. Everybody was fighting everybody. In fact, there's one theory that they would have probably wiped themselves out if the Russians hadn't helped them, which may not be true. But they did, their whole village setup was always built so that you could evacuate if the enemy came. And there were several different groups and two quite different languages. The Eastern Aleut is very, very different from the mm-hmm. Western Aleut. Really, and there's one thing about the chain that's fascinating is the mysteries. I think that's why I keep going back there. There's so many things we don't know. And there's records of tall Aleuts, and the legends spoke of tall Aleuts, a group of tall Aleuts, when most Aleuts today are short, shorter than average. And there's a church record of moving a colony of tall Aleuts to Attica. And unfortunately, they were all put in a group, and an avalanche got them one year, so we don't know very much about them. But scientists... archaeologists and anthropologists mm-hmm. think there might have been two separate groups.
So when we say what is an Aleut, we have to really explain what...
Well, of course, a lot of people tell you the Aleuts are just plain Russian, and they had trouble qualifying for the land claim settlement. At first, they weren't going to include the Aleuts because they said, well, they were intermarried with the Russians, and they're, you know, mm-hmm. most of them are half Russian. In fact, it's difficult to find anybody who can say that he's a pure Aleut. And if somebody does say that, you say, oh, you must be kidding. Because they didn't have much choice. Mm-hmm. They were simply stomped over by the Russians. But there's a lot more Aleut surviving than people probably think very much about.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if there is, with the isolation, with the changes in the weather, it just seems like a very unpredictable place to live.
You've got volcanoes, and on some of the islands there are things called bottomless bog holes. You fall in them, and then you come out on the other side of the island about a year later, not in very good shape. And tidal waves, although most of the villages were built on the Bering Sea side, where you wouldn't be as likely to be wiped out by a tidal wave. Yeah, there's you don't take too much for granted out there, and you have to be really good to survive.
Lael Morgan, author of the Alaska Geographic Edition on the Aleutians. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.